Welcome to the debate. So, imagine standing under a massive suspension bridge.
Okay.
If you look closely at the engineering, you'll see redundant cables, excess steel that, well, on a perfectly calm, sunny day, look like pure waste.
Right. To an accountant who's optimizing strictly for cost and weight, that extra material is a financial liability, just dead weight.
Exactly. But to the engineer, that exact waste is the only thing preventing total collapse when a Category 5 hurricane hits.
Which brings us to the core of today's discussion. We are taking that tension between ruthless efficiency and excess capacity, and we are applying it to the very fabric of how biology and human civilization evolve.
Right. We are exploring a fascinating June 2026 academic white paper by Dr. Bichara Sahali. It's titled The Evolution of Worlds: Natural Drift, Inverse Darwinism, and the Biology of Love.
Evolutionary and societal progress, primarily driven by scarcity, competition, and, the rigorous pruning of natural selection.
Or are they driven by conservation, redundancy, and what Dr. Sahali calls generative drift? So I defend the life-coherent generative drift model. I assert that redundancy, excess capacity, and relational safety are the true engines of biological and institutional innovation.
And I argue that without the rigorous discipline of selection, competitive pruning, and optimization, this so-called generative reserve reliably devolves into parasitic dependency and organizational rot.
Let's start with what the paper identifies as the selectionist myth. Because, we have essentially built a societal religion around survival of the fittest.
We definitely have.
Force everyone to compete and we trim all the fat. Well, we are mimicking the genius of nature.
The lean efficiency model.
Exactly. But this is a profound misreading of how biology actually innovates. Natural selection is really just a retrospective description of who survived. Selection is entirely subtractive.
Meaning it can only eliminate.
Yeah, it cannot create. True innovation requires what biologists Kalkman and Deakin call inverse Darwinism. That's the duplication and redundancy that buffer exploratory divergence.
So having extra parts.
Right. Excess capacity isn't waste. It's the vital permission life needs to wander around, to make errors without dying, and to discover new ways of living.
I understand the appeal of that framing. I really do. But it presents a highly romanticized view of excess capacity. It completely ignores the systemic dangers of what evolutionary biologists call constructive neutral evolution.
How so? I mean, when you have extra parts, you have more ways to solve a problem.
Not exactly. Yes, gene duplication occurs in nature. And yes, institutional redundancy exists. But we have to be fiercely objective about what unchecked redundancy usually produces.
Which is what, in your view?
Well, it doesn't usually produce genius. It produces Rube Goldberg machines, gratuitous complexity. In both biology and human institutions, when you remove selective pressure, those extra components don't just naturally wander into beautiful complementary symbioses.
They don't?
No.
More often than not, they become mutually dependent through a slow accumulation of losses. Think of a convoluted financial system or a bloated bureaucracy.
Oh, sure.
They add layers of administration and redundant checkboxes to compensate for past failures. Eventually, removing any one single part threatens the whole system because the parts have become locked in a web of dependency,
Right.
not because they are adaptively superior, right? Without rigorous selection, without a competitive pruning mechanism that eliminates the inefficient, that generative margin becomes a pathological ratchet.
A ratchet.
Yeah, it creates systems that act like tumors in a body. They consume the resources of the host merely to reproduce their own inherited inefficient arrangements. Margin without selection is just an engine of decay.
I think the tumor analogy actually reveals where the selectionist myth starts to crack, because it completely misunderstands the basic mechanism of how life generates anything new in the first place.
How so?
Well, the selectionist view treats the environment like an external examiner, right? Like a harsh teacher constantly testing organisms and discarding the weak.
Sure.
But evolution by natural drift, as articulated by the biologists Maturana and Empedocis, shows that organisms aren't striving to pass a test for some predetermined optimum. They simply change structurally while maintaining their basic living organization.
Ah,
You're talking about autopoiesis.
Exactly. For our listeners, autopoiesis just means a system's ability to constantly rebuild itself to stay alive. Think of how your cells regenerate to keep you functioning, even as the temperature or environment around you fluctuates.
Right.
Organisms just drift. And to drift safely without falling apart, they need a buffer.
But selection isn't merely the grim reaper you're making it out to be. It's not just a subtractive force operating in a vacuum. Selection acts to stabilize and refine fit.
Okay, but...
Let's look at the gene duplication you mentioned earlier. If a gene duplicates, giving an organism two copies of a crucial metabolic enzyme, that second copy is biologically expensive to maintain.
It takes energy, yes.
Exactly. The body is spending precious energy keeping it around. Without a selective pressure holding that duplicate to a strict standard of utility, it doesn't typically embark on a magical journey of discovery. It degrades.
Well,
it accumulates harmful mutations and becomes a pseudogene. It literally turns into meaningless biological noise. Selection is the rigorous force that prevents a system's genetic code from dissolving into total entropy. It forces that variation to either prove its worth or be excised before it drags the whole organism down.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. And I'll draw directly from the text's example of the evolution of trichromatic vision.
Okay.
So how we humans developed the ability to see a rich, multidimensional field of color. Our color vision didn't happen because natural selection incrementally sculpted a slightly better eye from nothing. It happened because of the duplication of an opsin gene.
Right, the gene duplicates. But as I said, usually that duplicate just degrades.
Usually, but not always. And this is the crux of how innovation works. When that opsin gene duplicated, the original copy continued to do the essential everyday work of basic wavelength sensitivity.
It kept the organism alive.
Exactly. That meant the duplicate was suddenly shielded from the lethal consequences of mutation. If the duplicate mutated and failed at basic light detection, the organism didn't go blind and die because the original gene was still working.
It had a backup.
Yes. The duplicate was granted a protected possibility space. Over a long period of time, it drifted, it mutated, and eventually the brain's comparison between the overlapping signals from the original gene and the mutated duplicate created an entirely new dimension of perception. Color vision.
But selection still played a role there?
Yes, but only after the fact. Natural selection couldn't have planned color vision. Selection only stabilized the relationship after the redundancy allowed the exploration to occur in the first place.
I see.
If you optimize away all your redundant pathways to achieve absolute lean efficiency, you lose the capacity to interpret variations. Let's use an analogy here, bringing in Shannon's information theory, which the text highlights.
Okay, let's hear it.
Think of Shannon's theory like talking on a cell phone in a really noisy room. If you speak with absolute zero waste efficiency, meaning you only say a single word exactly once, any static on the line means the message is lost forever.
You need to repeat yourself.
You need redundancy. Repeating yourself or adding extra context words ensures the message survives the noise. If a biological system trims all its chatter to be perfectly efficient, it effectively guarantees its own extinction the moment the environment shifts, because it has zero margin to interpret or adapt to new conditions.
That's a compelling argument. But have you considered that Shannon's information theory is actually the perfect analogy for my side of the debate?
Oh, really?
Yeah, because Shannon also mathematically proved that bandwidth is finite. If you fill a communication channel with too much redundancy, if you just repeat every single word 10 times, the signal-to-noise ratio completely collapses.
Well, sure, at extremes.
And the sheer metabolic cost of transmitting the message bankrupts the system. Let's move from molecular biology to human institutions, where this dynamic is glaringly obvious.
Okay.
When you take the pressure of selection off a human system, say a state monopoly or a massive unchecked administrative body, it doesn't use that generative reserve to invent the institutional equivalent of color vision. It undergoes what the paper identifies as institutional autopoietization.
Let's quickly define that for the audience. Institutional autopoietization is when a bureaucracy essentially forgets the reason it was created and just starts conserving its own procedures.
Exactly. The process becomes the product. a health system stops optimizing for actual patient healing and instead starts optimizing for the conservation of its billing metrics, you know, the growth of its administrative hierarchy, and its reputational security.
Right.
I come at it from a different way. You look at institutional margin and see a protective buffer. I look at social margin and see that it very often just protects entrenched, life-harming bureaucracy. Means become ends. The metrics displace the actual reality.
But isn't that just a poorly designed institution rather than a flaw in the concept of generative reserve itself?
No, it's the natural result of removing the threat of failure. You claim that reserve acts as a protective biology. I argue that unchecked reserve functions like a parasitic tumor.
A tumor again?
Yes. And let's look at how a tumor operates at the cellular level. A tumor is actually highly evolvable. It exploits variation, redundancy, and altered resource pathways wonderfully. It is incredibly innovative at keeping itself alive.
True.
But it is perfectly willing to destroy the living organism on which it depends, just to ensure its own local survival. When we protect an institutional margin from the pruning shears of selection and competition, we are usually just feeding an administrative tumor that consumes the life ground it was meant to serve.
That's an interesting point, though I would frame it differently. I think you are conflating system coherence with life coherence.
How so?
Well, I entirely agree that a bureaucracy can become highly coherent at reproducing itself while utterly failing its purpose. A DMV that is incredibly good at generating paperwork but terrible at issuing licenses is highly coherent.
Yes, precisely.
But your proposed solution, ruthless optimization and competitive pruning, is precisely what creates catastrophic vulnerability. Look at the tech's prime example, the COVID-19 pandemic.
The pandemic is a perfect example of poorly managed resources. Yes.
It's an example of the selectionist mindset failing in real time. For decades leading up to 2020, hospital administrators acted exactly like your preferred evolutionary pruning shears. They brought just-in-time supply chain logic to healthcare.
Which is highly efficient.
It is, on paper. They optimized health systems for average, everyday demand. They eliminated spare beds, they cut redundant staff, they reduced inventories of personal protective equipment, and they won awards for it. They celebrated their lean efficiency.
Right.
Because 99 days out of 100, that hurricane doesn't hit. But then the demand surged, and those hyper-optimized systems failed catastrophically. The tumor wasn't the empty hospital bed.
Okay.
The true pathology was the ideology that viewed an empty bed as a waste of money rather than a vital generative reserve. If we view overlapping expertise or idle capacity as pathological bloat that has to be aggressively pruned, aren't we blinding ourselves to the fact that optimization is often just a disguised form of extreme brittleness?
Brittleness?
Yes, a highly optimized system looks incredibly fit right up until the exact moment it shatters into a million pieces.
It shatters because the metrics of selection were misaligned, not because the fundamental principle of selection is flawed.
I don't know about that.
No, think about it. If a hospital board optimizes only for quarterly financial targets, then yes, it will fail during a once-in-a-century pandemic. But the answer to that isn't to romantically hoard limitless generative reserve, which frankly society cannot afford to fund.
Then what is the answer?
The answer is to improve our selective criteria, ensure our stress testing is more rigorous. The text itself acknowledges that we must distinguish between life-serving complementarity and pathological lock-in.
It does.
So I have to ask, how do you propose we actually do that, practically, without the pain of selection? How do you dismantle a bloated, tumor-like institution that is hiding behind the excuse of, oh, don't cut our funding, we are just maintaining our generative reserve?
By establishing what the paper calls a life-coherent evaluation. This means we evaluate systems not based on sheer survival or financial profit, but on whether an arrangement enlarges the capacities of living beings without transferring disabling costs onto others.
Okay.
But to do this, we have to move past the physical material reserve of hospital beds or supply closets. We have to talk about how human beings actually coordinate ideas. And this brings us to Maturana's concept of the biology of love.
Wait, I have to stop you there, because if our listeners are anything like me,
The minute they hear the phrase, biology of love, applied to institutional governance or evolutionary mechanics, alarm bells are going off.
Really?
Yes. It sounds incredibly naive. We are introducing love as a structural organizational mechanism. How does that not just become a free pass for bad actors?
I'm glad you stopped me, because we must be incredibly precise here. Majorana is not talking about romantic sentimentality, and he's not preaching a vague corporate doctrine of niceness. He uses love as a strict technical relational dynamic.
Technical love? Okay.
Love, in this framework, is the relational dynamic where the other arises as a legitimate other in coexistence.
Let's translate that into plain English.
It means creating relational safety. Think back to the duplicated gene. The duplicated gene provided a biological buffer that allowed for safe variation without killing the organism.
Right.
The biology of love provides a social and relational buffer. It means you don't get fired or destroyed the second you make an error or express a dissenting viewpoint.
I see.
If you have a hyper-selectionist institution where any deviation results in immediate annihilation or dispossession, what happens? Variation goes into hiding. The biology of love protects legitimate participation during moments of human difference. It allows vulnerability and disagreement to remain present in the room long enough for learning, repair, and true, unexpected solutions to emerge.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why.
Go ahead.
It sounds beautiful in a philosophical vacuum, but applying this as a governance structure is a recipe for a disaster. Granting unyielding legitimacy to every variation, to every dissenting action, or underperforming employee suppresses the critical feedback a system needs to expel genuinely harmful behaviors.
I disagree.
But human institutions are not immune to bad actors, to exploitation, to laziness, or to outright corruption. If you remove the fear of exclusion, if you say to a workforce, you are always a legitimate other in coexistence, regardless of your output or behavior, you destroy the incentive structures that motivate alignment. But you invite free riders to exploit the system. Institutions, frankly, require a baseline level of fear and scarcity to function properly. The threat of failure, the threat of losing one's position or losing market share to a competitor, is the immune response that prevents an organization from being cannibalized from within.
So fear is the immune system?
Yes. If you replace the rigorous pruning of selection with the biology of love, you are entirely disarming the institutional immune system. I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning because you are making a massive assumption. You are assuming that fear produces accurate feedback. But in reality, fear destroys the very information an institution needs to survive.
How?
Authoritarian systems or hyper-competitive corporate cultures ruled by the threat of the axe actually severely narrow collective intelligence.
How so?
It forces people to focus?
No, it forces people to hide. When subordinates know that a single mistake means they are out, they tailor every single word to please the boss. They massage every metric to look good on paper, and they cover up every error just to survive your selective pruning.
Well, that's bad management.
It's the inevitable result. The institution loses all access to objective, local knowledge. It becomes blind. Think of a medical culture ruled entirely by the fear of blame, liability, and losing one's license. What happens? Doctors start practicing defensive medicine.
True.
They order unnecessary tests just to cover their bases. They hide minor mistakes, and the entire culture of learning grinds to a halt. The biology of love, treating the other as legitimate, does not mean you accept harmful behavior.
Then what does it mean?
I mean, the child's absolute dignity and right to exist. The text makes this explicit. Love makes boundaries possible without requiring ontological negation, meaning you don't have to erase someone's right to participate just because you correct them.
I see the distinction.
Isn't the biology of love, then, actually the most rigorous operational mechanism for keeping a society's feedback loop accurate? Because without relational safety, people just lie to survive.
That is a fair point about defensive behavior. But people also lie when they are completely insulated from consequences. Let's look at the text's warning about cultural drift and recursive realities.
Okay.
Human cultures are essentially networks of conversations that conserve particular practices over time. When a group of administrators in a failing university or a bloated government agency sit around confirming each other's legitimacy, speaking in the comfortable language of participation and relational safety, they are very often just engaging in a recursive loop that protects their own status and salaries. They use the rhetoric of relational safety to deflect hard objective measurements of their failure to serve the public.
So you see it as a shield for incompetence.
Precisely. The paper notes that institutions materialize distinctions. When you remove the hard, undeniable metric of survival, when you say we won't prune this failing department because we value relational safety, you aren't eliminating the cost of failure.
You're shifting it.
The student, the patient, they are the ones who ultimately pay the price for this indulgent generative reserve. Selection is the cold water of reality. It forces an institution to face the facts rather than retreating into a cozy, self-congratulatory conversational bubble.
But we have to ask, what is the reality that selection forces them to face? If the selection metric is inherently flawed, if it's based purely on maximizing short-term monetary expansion or climbing arbitrary ranking systems, then the institution adapts to the metric, not to actual reality.
That's a metrics issue, though.
It's the core of what the paper calls structural coupling. Interventions don't happen to passive populations. They change how the population behaves. If your intervention is punitive, if it's based on scarcity and the threat of elimination, the population couples with that reality by becoming defensive, dependent, and silent.
I don't necessarily agree that it always leads to silence.
But it often does. Dr. Sally's framework of life-coherent generative drift proposes a completely different and far more productive sequence. Mutual legitimacy creates relational safety. That safety allows for tolerated difference. That difference leads to truthful exploration, which eventually leads to discovered complementarity.
It's a very nice sequence.
You simply cannot force a higher order capacity into existence with a whip. It has to be grown from a place of reserve.
And where does society find this reserve?
This is exactly why the civil commons, things like public health care, universal education, and ecological protection are so vital. They are society's shared physical generative reserve. They ensure that a person's ability to participate in the world, to take risks and innovate, doesn't depend entirely on their competitive purchasing power.
I don't disagree that public goods are essential to a functioning society, but even the civil commons must be subject to rigorous selective constraints. Otherwise, they collapse under their own weight.
They need evaluation, sure.
Right.
The text itself outlines a life-coherent institutional protocol. One of the core diagnostic questions it demands we ask is, which dependencies add genuine capacity and which merely reproduce inherited complexity?
That's a crucial question. And to honestly answer that question, you have to be willing to cut. You have to be willing to look at a program and say, this redundancy is no longer serving a living purpose. It is merely a neutral accretion, a bureaucratic Rube Goldberg machine.
Okay. My deep concern with the entire generative drift framework is that it provides endless academic justification for avoiding the hard, subtractive work that keeps civilizations agile and functional.
But the framework explicitly includes evaluation. The eighth step of Dr. Sahli's sequence is life coherence evaluation. It asks if the arrangement protects or restores life capacity, or if it externalizes harm. And the ninth step is renewal or lock-in.
But as the text is not blind to the existence of pathology, but it forcefully insists that the overarching grammar of our civilization must shift. We have to move from a foundational premise of scarcity and elimination to a premise of protected plurality.
But the evaluation must have teeth. If an institution is found to be life incoherent, if it is consuming vital reserve merely to maintain its own administrative bloat, the action taken must be subtractive. It must be Darwinian.
I mean, if it's genuinely pathological.
Yes. While I concede that generative margin provides the raw potential for innovation, the prepared possibility space, as the paper beautifully calls it, without the ruthless discipline of selection, organizations invariably drift toward institutional autopoietization. They consume the life ground they were meant to serve. Selection is the gravity that keeps the architectural structure grounded in reality.
And I summarize my position by returning to the extreme danger of that selectionist grammar.
An over-reliance on selection, competition, and pruning makes civilization fundamentally brittle.
Brittleness again.
Yes, it strips away the very margins we need to survive unforeseen disturbances, like a pandemic or an ecological collapse. Conserving generative margin, whether we are talking about redundant biological pathways, spare beds in a hospital, the civil commons of a society, or the relational safety of the biology of love, is the absolute prerequisite for keeping life capable of beneficial adaptation.
If we can afford it.
You simply cannot adapt if you have left yourself no room to move.
Well, it seems we find ourselves in a space of substantive, if tense, convergence on a few key realities here. We both agree, drawing from the text, that purely random variation without some form of conservation leads to total dissolution.
Absolutely. A system must conserve its basic living organization to even exist.
And we both recognize the profound danger of institutional autopoietization, that terrifying tendency of human systems to mistake their own procedural bureaucratic survival for true life capacity.
Yes, we definitely agree on the diagnosis of the pathology, but we remain in deep, substantive disagreement over the primary mechanism of salvation.
True.
You hold that competitive pruning and selective elimination are the necessary safeguards against systemic decay. I maintain that generative reserve, actively protecting the margin for error and preserving the legitimacy of the other, is the only real way to safeguard against the catastrophic brittleness of hyper-optimized systems.
Which brings us to the profound foundational question posed at the conclusion of Dr. Saheli's white paper. What must we conserve together if life is to remain capable of becoming otherwise?
It is a profound question, and one that requires us to look past our balance sheets and our lean efficiency metrics. There is far more depth to explore in the framework of life-coherent generative drift, from how we design our artificial intelligence to how we govern our natural ecosystems.
There certainly is.
We leave you, the listener, to form your own conclusion on the optimal balance between generative margin and evolutionary selection. But the next time you drive over a massive suspension bridge, take a moment to look at the redundant steel cables holding it aloft. Ask yourself if you would prefer the engineer who valued the generative margin of safety or the accountant who wanted to selectively prune the waste.
Or perhaps ask yourself if that bridge could have ever been built at all without an architect willing to strictly eliminate the designs that simply couldn't carry the load.
Thank you for joining us. We will see you next time.